Occult Confessions is brought to you commercial free through the generous support of our patrons. Visit occultconfessions.com and click on donate to help keep the history of the occult on the digital airwaves. Utah was the 45th state to join the United States. It's named for the Ute, one of many native groups to settle in the region. Ute means people of the mountains, but strangely is not a word used by the Ute people, who don't actually call themselves the Ute people. They go by Nuchi. The name Ute was likely given to the Nuchi by the Pueblo Indians and then taken by the state of Utah. In 1540, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado passed through southern Utah looking for the legendary Seven Cities of Gold, or Cibola, rumored to exist across the desert to the north. In 1821, it became part of Alta California, a territory of Mexico, and in 1824, Jim Bridger happened across the Great Salt Lake and confused it for the Pacific Ocean. Bridger's discovery brought hundreds of fur traders and trappers from the United States and Canada to the region, where they set up trading posts, and the spot became a stop for migrants along the route to the coast. Then, in 1847, a man arrived who would change the face of the region by orchestrating a mass project of settlement. He would go by the titles of governor and prophet, and bring with him over 30 wives. This man was Brigham Young, leader of the Latter-day Saints, and his rule over Utah would bring purpose, prosperity, pain, and bloodshed to the tens of thousands who followed him out into the desert. This is Occult Confessions. Today's episode is called Utah. My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson. I am your supreme hierophant of your secret order of alchemical actors, joined this day by the dynamic duo from the south and the north, respectively, Jake Wheatley, our Knight of the Dangling Serpent.
Woot woot.
Sorry, man. What do you know about the Mormons?
What is it? Hasadiga Ibawe. In the
what is that?
Is that the title of the song from Book of Mormon?
I see.
Well, I don't know if I can
we'll
say
bleep
that.
Some Oops. Of that. Yeah.
Oops. I think that's the first time I've ever cussed on here.
Ever.
No, oh, it, ever. Ever. I don't ever curse.
The state of Utah brought it out of you.
It usually does.
That's the other voice from the north, Nikki Hiller Anderson, our Naked Truth.
Hello.
You've met some Mormons, have you not?
Yes, they accosted me on the street.
Is it because you were smoking?
Probably. I was smoking. I was drinking an energy drink. I'm like waiting for the fuss. Probably looking
sugar. They call it a whiff.
Holy. I have had multiple people from different religions try to hand me religious, like, scripture just out of nowhere when I'm walking around. I don't know what it is about me that screams need saving, but something
it's your look.
Something's like, getting attention. I'm literally wearing a shirt with like a Grim Reaper on it. I got two nose piercings. Like, what do you mean? I'm so approachable. No.
You look too alty for your own good.
Yes, and looks like I need saving. And so they came up to me and, you know, did their usual spiel, but I just doubled down. I'm like, I love the Lord, big fan. Can't convert me. I'm already there, so...
Yeah, so they don't bother. They just leave you alone.
Yeah, I threw them right off. They were like, oh, do you like have any friends that need saving? I was like, nope, we're all so holy. All of us.
Cigarette smoking, energy drinks, swilling.
Yeah.
All right, let's pledge it out.
We, the members of the secret order of alchemical actors,
do solemnly commit ourselves to a full and honest telling of the history of the occult as far as we know it. The Youngs were early converts to Mormonism. In 1830, Joseph Smith's brother Samuel was traveling Pennsylvania and New York and met the Methodist preacher Phineas Young, who took an interest in the book Samuel was selling. Phineas passed the book to his father, then his sister Fanny, finally Brigham. I love these old names. Don't you guys love these old names? Phineas and Fanny.
Ferb and... Yeah.
Oh yes, Ferb. I haven't gotten to Ferb yet.
Oh, sorry. Spoilers.
So, though his family members were already impressed, Brigham wanted to see whether there was good common sense manifest in Smith's revelation. Still, the family were not ready to convert and wouldn't be until an acquaintance, Solomon Chamberlain, showed them the book again and said that everyone must believe the Book of Mormon or be lost. The Youngs discovered that the book had answers to questions about life and the afterlife that they had not been resolved by any other denomination they encountered, and so Mormon they were. Brigham's youngest brother, Lorenzo, had dreamed when he was 9 years old about a chariot riding up to him containing the Savior. The Savior asked him where his brother Brigham was, and also about his other family members, but this dream charioteer was most interested in Brigham. Young was less inclined to read than his brothers and believed it was his duty to keep his passions under control at all times. Like many other young men at the time, Brigham Young sought the right faith for him and spent many anxious hours poring over the question before finally settling on Methodism. But even then, he felt the you thought I was going to say Mormonism?
It's close. I feel like Methodism is always like the entry. It was my entry.
The stepping stone.
Protestantism. Yeah.
Step one. It's easy. It's one of the easier ones.
Eases you into it.
It's chill.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty chill. Yeah. It's not like baptism where you got that whole thing you got to do with the water and all.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have to do baptism, but they do that for the children, right? The Methodists.
Yeah, they christen them first.
Yeah, and it doesn't have all the, you know, fanciness of the Episcopalians. There's not all the crazy robes and stuff. It's Protestantism. What are we saying? User-friendly. User-friendly Protestantism.
It's Protestant light. It's the one that you like go into before you have to pay the subscription to get the full version. Like, that's messed up. I can say that I was Methodist before I became Pentecostal.
Who knew we'd be messing with them? You know, my family was Methodist as well.
See, it's the entry point.
Not my immediate family, of course, but my father had grown up Methodist. Anyway, Brigham felt the Methodists lacked sufficient teaching about man's relationship to God. So take that. Poor Methodists. We love you guys. Brigham and Phineas traveled by sleigh with Heber Kimball and their wives from New York to Bradford County, Pennsylvania, to attend a Mormon meeting in January 1832. They stayed for 6 days. It was quite a meeting, during which these early Mormons spoke in tongues and prophesied. Not too common Mormon practices today, I don't think.
No, I've never heard of Mormons speaking in tongues.
Yeah, it's a little bit... what's the word I'm looking for? Charismatic for Mormons. Brigham packed his things a few days after his return and went to see his brother, Joseph, who was living in Kingston, Ontario. Oh, he's in Canada, man.
Yeah. And, well, maybe. Yeah. I don't know him yet, so I don't want to cheer and too Joseph, hard.
Well, they were easily persuaded. So Brigham went up there. So he had that six-day meeting, packed his stuff, and said, I got to tell my brother Joseph. Packed his stuff, went to Ontario, and Joseph was persuaded to join the new faith. On April the 15th, he was baptized by Eleazar Miller in the cold water of his own mill pond and was declared an elder of the church more or less right there on the spot.
In Ontario? In outside water? He's, they baptized
no,
him?
No, he's probably in upstate New York at this point.
Okay,
but
I was
still,
gonna say, whew, that, yeah, that would be cold. But still, yeah.
Slightly warmer in upstate New York, but only slightly. It's April 15th, after all. He gave his first sermon the next week without prepared notes. He gave up his shop in Mendon and went on the road with Heber Kimball, leaving his ailing wife in the care of Kimball's wife, Valate, to be an itinerant preacher. Brigham and Kimball's method was to politely get into homes, going door to door, and become acquainted with the family before preaching to them. I think the South Park actually did a reasonable job of showing how this works. Like, you make friends with the family, you don't start out, hey, can I introduce you to Jesus? Now, I know the missionaries do go door-to-door doing that kind of business, but the best plan is this, to get to know people first.
Yeah, just a stranger come up to your door, say, hey, how you doing? Do you want to get a drink, maybe?
Yeah, how are things? Let's be friends. Yeah. I'm just going door-to-door in this skinny black tie looking for friends. In Ohio, he met Joseph Smith for the first time and spoke in tongues in front of him. Some wondered if this was of the devil. Yeah, right?
For the first time meeting someone.
Hey, I love your religion. I'm just going to speak in tongues for a second. Give me a sec. Smith said, Joseph Smith, the people weren't sure if he was on board with the speaking in tongues, and actually sometimes he wasn't, but in this case he said it was of God, and Joseph Smith spoke in tongues himself a bit after that. It's like, oh, that's pretty cool.
So he got to decide if it was, like, godly or demonic.
Or of the devil, yeah.
It's all about the inflection.
Right. It's how you speak in tongues, whether it sounds mean or not.
Usually it does sound scary.
It does often sound scary. It is wild.
Yeah.
Neither continued the practice after 1832, though, so it was a really brief time that they did this. His wife Miriam died on the 8th of September, and the Kimballs took in his daughters Elizabeth and Violette, leaving Brigham to focus on his new religion. Or Violet. It's probably Violet. Why am I saying Violette? It's probably Violet.
Violette.
It's spelled that way, though. It's not spelled like the flower. It's spelled V-I-L-A-T-E.
I like it. It has some flair. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Young went with Smith to Kirtland, Ohio, a midway point for the Mormons on their way to establish Zion in Jackson City, Missouri. Young survived on money he earned building houses in the new Mormon town, and he met Marianne Angle, who he married on the 18th of February, 1834, when he was 32 and she was 30. Age-appropriate marriage. Good job, Brigham Young.
We love to see
We're not
it.
Gonna... Not all 30 of them are gonna be that way, but off to a good start. This is his second marriage, right? He already has two children. The Mormons established the city of Zion in Jackson County, or tried to, but they were attacked and forced from their homes, and Missouri Governor Daniel Dunklin promised to restore their homes if Joseph Smith could provide assistance. Smith raised a regiment of about 200, including Young and Kimball. So in other words, the Mormons are in trouble, they're being attacked by mobs, and the governor says, listen, I'll give you some help, but can you help yourself a bit here? Can you guys organize a militia? And Smith says, yeah, let's do that. So the trip to, what am I trying to say here? Smith raised a regiment of about 200. The trip would cover about 2,000 miles and take 45 days one way to go from Kirtland to Jackson County.
Walking?
Yeah, they walk. Yeah, they got to march.
So just build an army really quick and then
you'd be so
walk. Take them on a walk.
You'd be so Go tired by the time you got there. You get there to fight and you've been walking for 45 days. You just have nothing left.
I mean, this is how it went, though. In the Civil War and all, that's what these guys did. They walked up and down the East Coast.
Built different. People were built
seriously.
Different.
Seriously.
Get winded walking a block now. It's crazy. That's not true, but...
If Nikki Scotter smokes in her energy drink, she can go for days. You gave up smoking, didn't you?
I did,
Did you give up smoking, Nikki?
Yeah, I quit smoking cigarettes. Now she can walk even further. Exactly, yeah.
Did you give up energy drinks?
No.
No, I still got those.
I love
caffeine.
That's
next, man. That's next. Okay, anyway. So let me tell you, this gets worse, though. You're just worried about the walking. That's not even the half of it. So,
my priorities. I'm like, oh, God, that's so far.
Dunklin withdrew his support as the Mormons neared their destination, and a mob came to break up and destroy Smith's Zion camp, but a storm raged up with hail and drove their rivals away. This fortune, or divine providence, was short-lived, for cholera then visited the camp.
Well, you win some, you lose some. Give and take.
68 people, including Joseph Smith and neighbor Kimball, were stricken with cholera. 14 of them died. If you don't know what cholera is, I really don't want to explain it. It's pretty gross, but it involves, like, you dehydrate. You basically can't keep water in your body. Yeah. So the cure for cholera really is like an IV.
Yeah, which, I mean,
it's that simple.
Just didn't have with them, no, especially.
They didn't,
yeah.
They didn't have those. I mean, but theoretically, if you can hydrate yourself, right? Like, if you think
yeah,
if you've had
your
like
water intake needs to be insane.
Yeah, and yeah, regimented. Anyway, Young, along with his brother Joseph, were spared. So Brigham Young never contracted the cholera, and they spent their time aiding the sick and burying the dead. So really brave, honestly. The early story of Brigham Young, I think, is. He's a pretty okay guy. Like, he's really capable. Like, he can build his own houses and he can quit his jobs and, like, leave his shop behind and just walk off and make a living building houses for people by himself. He, It's really an interesting, like, hard, you know, they don't make them, right? What are you guys saying? They don't build them like that anymore.
And also, I think it's easy for him to see, like, a lot of things as divine intervention, like the storm coming and stopping the mob, and then everyone gets sick, but him and his brother are okay. Like, of course you think you're, like, chosen for something at that point.
It feels like the finger of God, yeah, has selected him. On the 3rd of July, 1834, the journey ended, and the company was discharged, and the Youngs and Kimball headed home. Then on Valentine's Day, 1835, Joseph Smith gathered the men from his Camp Zion expedition together, and three witnesses of the Golden Plates, namely Martin Harris, Oliver Cowdery, and David Whitmer, selected the 12, the 12 apostles, to become his, you know, buddies.
His crew.
Yeah. His apostles. So now he has 12 apostles. Brigham Young and Heber Kimball were the second and third names called to become his apostles. After anointing a further 70 men to serve as missionaries and helping to dedicate the Kirtland Temple, Young set out with his brother Joseph for New England to win converts. The missionaries went door to door, seeking hospitality and preaching, just like they do today. I don't know if they ask for hospitality anymore. Maybe they should.
To stay there? Or just
yeah, can leave? I stay the night? Can you? Yeah, can I sit down to dinner with you? But that was a different time. People did this.
Them just kind of like mimicking stuff from the Bible?
It's very Jesus-y. Yeah, it's very Jesus-y. Three apostles were excommunicated for deciding that Smith was unfit to function as a temporal leader, and mob violence forced the Mormons to continue on their quest for Zion. So they're thrown out of Missouri, and some of the Mormons start to doubt whether Smith is capable of actually, like, managing the Mormons politically and temporally. They think, oh, he's a spiritual leader, and he you know, talked to God, but that doesn't mean that he should run the show. Separation of church and state, you know?
Wow, that's very forward-thinking.
Well, they got excommunicated.
Dang it. It's because they were onto something.
Young traveled with the prophet from Quincy to far west Missouri. The Mormons continued to meet resistance, including mobs who prevented them from voting in Gallatin, Missouri, and a group of Mormon vigilantes, the Danites, rose up to burn down non-Mormons' homes. Young denounced the Danites.
That doesn't sound very holy very enough Mormon. The Lord. Batman.
Jesus.
So Brigham Young said, no, this is bad. You guys shouldn't be burning down houses. More apostles left, more were replaced. Young and Kimball assumed a senior position among the 12. So within that time, right, very quickly, Joseph and Brigham Young become Joseph Smith's, like, top guys. Not the top guys, a few other guys kicking around there, but they're at the top of
working
the apostles.
Way up.
Mm-hmm. When Joseph and Hiram Smith were arrested in Missouri, Young and Kimball were overlooked and took over management of the church. So they forgot to arrest Brigham Young. The finger of God, man. Like, over and over again, he really does luck out.
Of course.
Karma works quick, but God works quicker.
Right? Is that how you convert Buddhists?
Yeah.
In mid-February 1839, they left far west with their families to travel to Illinois. So they're sort of taking a lead role in reorganizing the church now that they're getting thrown out of Missouri. From 1840 to 1841, Young lived in England, working to convert a nation racked by poverty to the Church of the Latter-day Saints. He organized a general conference of 1,600 people to preach to, had 3,000 Mormon hymn books and 5,000 copies of the Book of Mormon printed, and sent an ornately bound copy to Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Can you imagine?
So what am I going to do with this?
Yeah, especially if you've heard our episode on the Book of Mormon. In England, he was noted for his... Not the musical, Jake. In England, he was noted for his contagious enthusiasm and good humor. But he was disappointed in the results of his labors. There were too many preachers and too many gods and gospels in London, and he complained that only a handful of those he preached to had converted. So there's just too much competition to win over London's poor. There's all these missionaries running around trying to get people to join their churches. But it was certainly more than a handful who ended up joining. Young, with two of his fellow apostles, contracted a ship to transport 235 converts to New Orleans, and another ship followed with 109 more. Because the first thing you do when you convert to Mormonism is head off for some of that jambalaya and some of that sweet jazz music, which won't exist for, you know, 70 years. After Young returned, Smith... I'm kidding. New Orleans was just the gateway to America. It was your port city.
No, they were really craving that crawfish. That's
yeah, man. Oof. I'm going to New Orleans in a month. I can't wait.
I just had some, actually.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you got, you're on the Gulf of, you know...
Yeah.
Mexico.
Sorry, Gulf of America now?
Right, I'm sorry. Thank you. That's why I hesitated. After Young returned, Smith told him it was no longer required that Young leave his family. Young was home to stay. So that was his last departure from his family. Remember, he's left his family over and over again throughout these years. And finally, Smith says, you can stay. You can stay home. But he was in Boston on yet another preaching tour when he heard the news of the prophet's death in Carthage. Sidney Rigdon, who was so close to Smith at the outset that he was accused of ghostwriting the Book of Mormon, stepped forward to take the dead prophet's place. Rigdon claimed that Smith would speak through him, but Young wasn't having it. Brigham countered that as the president of the Twelve, he had the keys and the means of obtaining the mind of God on the subject of Smith's successor. On the 8th of August, the saints assembled in the morning to hear both sides of the argument. Rigdon spoke first and at length. Then Young got up to speak, and many in the audience described how the mantle of the prophet suddenly rested on Brigham Young, and the people thought they were seeing Joseph Smith before them. Young pointed out that Rigdon had been alienated from Smith for 2 years. At one point, Smith had attempted to remove Rigdon from the church, but the membership wouldn't let him. Young said that the people should not endeavor to elect a prophet, but that the leadership should rest with the 12 apostles. Young succeeded, and Rigdon, refusing to give up his claim, was excommunicated a month later. But Young had not seen the last of his rivals. Did you guys follow all that back and forth?
Yes.
More or less.
There's a lot of moving around.
Where did we land?
Well, we landed on Brigham Young.
I meant geographically.
Well, we're still in Nauvoo. We're in Illinois. So we've gone from Kirtland to Missouri, from Ohio, I should say, to Missouri, and now we're in Illinois. But we're getting thrown out of Illinois, and Brigham Young has assumed leadership because Joseph Smith has just been killed, and he's going to, you know, make the next grand trip for us. So far, so good?
Yes.
In the commotion over succession, Brigham Young had made one very important omission. He had failed to visit the widow of Joseph Smith, Emma Hale Smith. As a result, she sided with Rigdon, driven in no small part by Young's participation in plural marriage, which Emma Smith hated. In fact, Young took on many of Smith's plural wives, according to Old Testament custom, and had 12 wives and 9 children by the year 1846.
So you're a woman and your husband dies, you and all your sister wives just get a new one? Just this guy now?
In theory, you should, your brother, his brother, your husband's brother should take you in. But since the apostles were sort of like the brothers of Joseph Smith, I think Joseph Smith had one surviving brother after all these events, so they helped take in the wives.
Okay, so was it just because, like, women couldn't provide for themselves, they needed, like, a man to take care of them? Or was it like, you have to marry this man now, like, this is your new husband?
Both.
Okay.
The answer is
two.
Yes,
things can be true.
Yes, it's difficult for a woman to provide for herself, therefore leaving her, especially with children, without a husband to help provide.
Yeah, you can't work, you can't have property,
good.
You can't do anything.
I mean, 19th century, like Civil War era, you were an orphan if your father died. Your mother could still be alive. You were still an orphan. And orphanages often contained women and children who had lost their breadwinner, literal breadwinner. Because it is hard for a woman to make a living at this time period.
You could just end it at, it's hard for a woman, period.
But yeah, for sure. And think about it. Brigham Young builds houses just like for fun. So this is not a bad guy to be linked up to.
That's a pretty good deal.
But you do have a lot of sister wives.
I mean, so. You know, built-in besties, maybe.
That's literally what I was about to say.
You guys can all complain about the same man.
It's worth taking a moment to do some accounting of Young's wives and children, taken from his biographer Leonard Arrington. Over time, he had 5 children by Clarissa Decker, 4 children with Clarissa Ross, 2 with Margaret Maria Alley, 10 with Emmeline Free. Oh, Emmeline. 1 with Margaret Pierce, 5 with Louisa Beeman, 7 with Emily Dow Partridge, and 1 with Zena Huntington Jacobs. He also had additional wives with whom he didn't have children, including Eliza Snow. Did you do the math there?
I was trying to, but you were a little fast.
That must be so confusing, having 2 wives with the same name.
And so many children. 10. But 10 with Emmeline.
I have to imagine he didn't bother keeping track of names at that point, probably. It's just AU.
Emma Smith also resented being asked to lend Young the prophet's uniform and horse, which Young believed were part of Smith's governmental office and not his personal property. The question of what was church property and what belonged to Joseph and now Emma Smith became another major point of contention. It wasn't entirely clear how much of Joseph's property was actually church property. Emma sought to provide for her children, and Young sought to provide for a church full of poor migrants. But the property in Nauvoo plummeted in value anyway when the Mormons were forced to leave the state. Imagine, like, an entire town has to pack up and leave. What's going to be the value of those homes now? Arrington observes that while these events drove an irrevocable wedge between Emma Smith and Brigham Young, both Emma Smith and Brigham Young died calling out for the prophet Joseph Smith. Kind of romantic.
Oh.
Bromance.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't make bros like that anymore. Die calling out your name.
No. My bros let me down like that.
Always dying, calling out other bros' names.
I know.
Come on, man. As the Saints' new leader, Young made plans to relocate to the Rocky Mountain region, specifically the Bear River Valley by the Great Salt Lake. This should sound familiar, yes? Mobs began the carefully planned burning of Mormon homes and farms on the outskirts of Nauvoo. This is like orchestrated terrorism.
Jeez.
Like carefully planned terrorism. They initially destroyed 44 buildings, and then by the fall of 1845, more than 200, as well as murdering some men and sexually assaulting their wives and daughters. So we were giggling a little bit.
No.
Just horrible the way the Mormons were treated.
No.
Yeah, it was escalating violence to get them out of Illinois. Ugh. They were well and truly hated, I think, just as a matter of prejudice.
Yeah, religious prejudice. You come in with new religious ideas and people that live there have their own and don't
I mean
change.
I want to remind us that Joseph Smith did raise a militia. Joseph Smith did attempt to run for president.
Did they also burn down houses of non-Mormons?
The militia, the Danites did, not the militia, the Danites did. There was a bit of tit for tat with the Mormons. So the people's complaint, the non-Mormons' complaint against Mormons was in part that they were organizing politically and militarily, and they felt threatened by that. However, the Mormons were not the aggressors in these instances, and after Joseph Smith was killed, the Mormons were sort of, like, disheartened, and this was really kicking them while they were down. Young prepared to send 1,500 men on an expedition to begin settling the Great Salt Lake Valley. Thomas Ford, governor of Illinois, warned that federal troops were gathering in St. Louis and planning to intercept and massacre the Mormons, but this was most likely a false rumor concocted to get the Mormons moving. It doesn't make sense that the federal government would massacre them. That would be not great for public relations. Additionally, an indictment had been fabricated accusing Young and other Mormon leaders of counterfeiting money. The Mormons began to cross the Mississippi in February, and by the middle of May, over 10,000 had evacuated Nauvoo, establishing temporary residence on the lands of the Potawatomi Indians. Let's take a minute for the Potawatomi Indians, shall we? Several years earlier, the Potawatomi had been removed from Missouri around the same time as the Mormons were forced out. The Potawatomi had found a temporary home on the Missouri River, but were asked to leave and offered steamboat transportation to Iowa. In Council Bluffs, they focused on trade. They established saw and grist mills to serve Mormon travelers on the road to the Great Salt Lake. The Potawatomi were known for siding with America's enemies, including the French in the French and Indian War and the British in both the American Revolution and the War of 1812. Gee, I wonder why.
I was going to say, you can't really blame them for that.
Right. They were picking the right team from their perspective. They just happened to lose. During the forced removals of the 1830s, they split into two groups. The Potawatomi of the Woods moved north into Canada, and the Prairie Potawatomi moved to Iowa and Kansas. They met with Joseph Smith in 1843, believing he would serve as an ally against the American government. Their government interpreter thwarted the Indians' effort to strike an alliance, but arranged another meeting at which Smith gave them a Book of Mormon and told them not to kill, but to ask God for assistance. Smith also gave them pages from his Abraham Papyrus and some oxen and horses. On the trek to the Great Salt Lake, they established a temporary settlement among the Potawatomi after receiving government and native permission, and after they arrived in Utah, Young wrote back to the Iowa's tribes that they were welcome to come and establish themselves in Utah with the Mormons. While they enjoyed friendly relations with the Potawatomi, the terms were more adversarial with the Omaha as they worked their way west. Writing for Brigham Young University Studies Quarterly, Lawrence Coates theorized that the Omahas were not as economically secure as the Potawatomi, which instigated conflict over resources with the Mormons. So in other words, the Potawatomi had been kicked around by the federal government, but the Mormons were also getting kicked around by the government. So it was an attempt for them to, like, be friends. Yeah. Maybe work together politically. It never quite worked out that way, but the Potawatomi did take care of them more or less and collaborate with them for the time that they were passing through. And they had a good relationship. The Omahas, it makes sense that they were just like worried that these white people were coming in to take what little they had.
Again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. 148 people made the initial trek across the plains from Iowa to Salt Lake City, led by Brigham. War parties burned the grass ahead of them, making it difficult to transport their livestock. Again, the Omaha are not happy that they're there. But Young insisted that they hunt the bison sparingly, never wasting life and flesh needlessly. Along the way, Young had cause to scold his fellow Mormons, who had resorted to card playing, checkers, and dominoes, as well as dancing, putting on acts, and get this, you guys are not going to like this, hoeing down.
What?
Are you talking about a hoedown throwdown?
Are you kidding?
They were hoeing down. Brigham Young did not like them hoeing down.
It was my favorite thing to do.
Get those hoes back up. Get those hoes back up.
He told them it was quite time to quit it.
Told them.
Too much hoeing.
It was too much hoeing. They met the mountain man James Bridger along the way. We mentioned him at the beginning, who told them that the valley was a fine place to settle, but that they should establish that grain could grow in the valley before bringing more people out. Young contracted mountain fever on the road and suffered with it through the summer, but on the 23rd of July, he finally sighted the Salt Lake Valley. God's just testing him there, giving him a little test. After establishing their new Zion, Young was selected to lead the first presidency, supported by Heber Kimball and Willard Richards, who had been with Smith at his assassination. Willard Richards, that is, survived the Smith assassination, right? Remember, two guys were killed, Smith and Hiram, and two guys survived. Willard Richards was one of the guys who survived, and there he is in Utah with Brigham Young. The first presidency, who operated from the Salt Lake Valley while the 12 went out to conduct the Mormons' mission to the world, would be led by Brigham Young. As president, he stipulated that he should be recognized as the principal spokesman of God on earth, who would consult the 12 and his counselors, but it would be better to join Joseph in the grave, he said, than to have to turn to them every time he had to speak with the public. So, my man wants his authority.
I'm in charge. Yeah. Sit down.
Respect his authority.
If you make me work with other people, I will literally kill myself. Drama queen.
Yeah, he's going to be on top. It's his way or the highway. He's a kind of a pope now, right? He's talking for God. He's talking with God. In 1848, he called on all Mormons to join him in Utah and led a group of 1,229 Mormons across the plains to the Mormons' new home. He's a tough man. He really is a tough man.
That's insane.
Yeah, these are all tough
another
people.
Another exodus.
Yeah. They're, I mean, think about the amount of ground they've crossed. These people, some of them, Brigham, started in New York State, and he's all the way in Utah now.
The calves on these people are crazy.
A significant story.
Real, that's a lot.
So I we're going to end up saying not great things about Brigham Young going forward here, because all people are complicated, right? And nobody's perfect. But I want to tell a story that paints him in a very good light, because I do think Brigham Young had a many, many redeeming qualities and many, many wives. A significant...
Is that one of the redeeming qualities?
That is not one of the redeeming qualities, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm undercutting my point as I say it. I don't want people to be like, oh, Rob, stop lionizing this, you know, womanizer.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the culture Joseph Smith established, so we've already been through that. A significant story about Young's character comes from this journey of the 1,229 across the plains. A week from just giving birth, a Mormon pioneer named Lucy Groves fell out of her wagon while it was moving, and she was hit by the wagon's front wheel, which broke three of her ribs and her leg.
Oh, my God.
Brigham Young set her leg, gave her a blessing, she was set up on a bed inside the wagon. A week later, her daughter, who was handling all of her mother's chores, accidentally tripped over her leg, breaking it again.
Oh, no!
Oh, ow.
Oh, God.
Ow.
Lucy Groves told her husband that they would have to leave the wagon train and stop. They would have to, you know, stop out, which was could be a death sentence, you know, under the circumstances. When Young saw their wagon pull out, he stopped the whole train and rode back to see the Groves family. Lucy was in so much pain that her leg ached every time the wagon bumped, and it bumped quite a bit because they're just crossing the grassy plains. And so she said the Mormons should carry on without her. She's trying to, you know, make a sacrifice for the greater good. But Brigham Young ordered the pioneers to set up camp, and he refashioned the Groves wagon himself so that it would swing like a hammock rather than bump along as they traveled.
So smart.
Yes, isn't it? He's very ingenious, very mechanically gifted. He then rode by Lucy's side for several days to make sure she had no more pain. He then stayed with the family, right? The leader of this whole expedition.
That's how you get a following that's committed to you.
Yeah.
I mean,
you earn it in those moments, right?
Yeah, you get that personal with them and like show that you care about them as a person. I'm sure they're willing to follow you to your grave.
But he's also, yeah, it's not like, I mean, we talk about cults, right? You guys have talked about cults with me, like where you're abusive to your cult members. But Young is legitimately helping these people.
Yeah.
In very direct, meaningful ways. He was largely impressed by the comportment of the Mormons on this journey, although he scolded them when they killed too many buffalo, and he joined them this time in dancing, song fests, and comical readings, but no hoeing down.
Aw, there's a line. Get him to hoe down yet. Maybe the next trip.
Nikki keeps asking, and Brigham keeps saying, I shall have song fests with you.
I'm like, and you'll hoe down?
No.
Dang it.
No hoeing.
Just a little hoeing.
Songfests, I say. On September the 20th, the larger migration of pioneers arrived, and after all of his travels, Brigham Young established his home, where he would remain for the rest of his life. We're not done with him, but he's finally done moving.
Finally, sit down for a sec.
He's been all over, right? He was in Boston when Smith was killed. He's in London. He's in New York. He's in Kirtland. He's all over. Land was distributed according to a drawing, with plots going to polygamists per family, widows, and divorced men who were the heads of families. Unmarried men did not receive plots.
Go get yourself
a couple of wives. Yeah, okay. Get a couple, come back to us. Young's own compound for his 11 connubial wives, 35 children and caretaker wives and foster children. Connubial meaning the 11 women he had sex with in order to produce children.
Oh, that's so the term for that?
Yes, he had 11 of those, 35 children. He had caretaker wives, he had foster children. His compound, his personal compound, had its own blacksmith, its own carpentry shop, and was surrounded by an 8-foot cobblestone wall.
I just feel like I'm so behind in life now. Jesus.
You need 35 kids to get this amount of work done.
And at least an 8-foot wall, man. What are you doing? You don't even have a 7-foot wall.
Hmm.
Through 1852.
Win some and lose some, I guess.
That's the spirit. That's the spirit. You take them on the chin and just get back up and put another foot on your wall.
I will.
Through 1852, 3,000 to 4,000 people immigrated to the valley as the Mormons in Iowa, Illinois, and Missouri made their way west. After 1852, roughly 3,000 migrants arrived each year from Great Britain and Scandinavia. By 1857, there were 35,000 Latter-day Saints in the Great Basin. And within 20 years, that number had grown to 120,000.
The numbers always shock me. Like, every time you mention a number, it's just so much bigger than I thought.
It grew exponentially because the missionaries are sending people back. And these people are often, like, you know, poverty-stricken and desperate. They're offered a better life. It's not easy being a pioneer in Utah, but it's better than starving in the slums of London.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
Men who could work developed public projects during the winter months when they weren't farming, and young organized immigrants into colonizing parties who went off to settle new parts of Utah. Determined not to rely on non-Mormons, Young compelled settlers to raise crops like cotton that didn't grow easily in the desert. The gold rush brought income into the region in the form of traveling miners, and Young sent 52 men to mine gold for the church. God helped fund much of the migration that took place in the 18... Oh, sorry, gold. Did I say God?
Yes, I was literally just going to be like, and how exactly?
He was speaking through you.
With gold. Gold helped fund much of the migration that took place in the 1850s. God's gold.
I'm sure God helped. I mean, he seems to have a hand in all of this.
He keeps pointing the gold out to Brigham. In July 1857, the postmaster refused to pass along the mail to Utah's Brigham Young Express. The mail, yes, was named after him. Because the federal government had determined to change its relationship with the Utah Territory by sending a contingent of federal troops to the region. Utah's legal sanction of polygamy was paired with slavery as barbarisms that Republican politicians in Washington couldn't abide to persist in the territories. One of Brigham's own plural wives, Ann Eliza Young, would make the politics of polygamy significantly worse decades later, but in the late 1850s, this meant that the government sent troops and a new governor, who operated largely in name only, while Brigham Young graciously welcomed him and continued to run the place. So the American government is like, you guys have slavery out there, and you have plural wives, and it ain't cool, and we're sending our own federal government to run you. We can't let you run yourselves. It just isn't okay. It's barbaric. But Mormons were increasingly paranoid about outsiders resuming their persecution of the Mormons, even all the way off in the Utah Territory. A Mrs. Hector McLean of New Orleans had converted to Mormonism and planned to bring her children to Salt Lake City, but her husband was not a Mormon and did not approve of his wife absconding. She absconded, you guys, with his children. Yeah. Absconded with them. Mrs. McLean had married Parley P. Pratt as one of his plural wives, and he arranged to meet her, but he was intercepted by Hector McLean, who shot at him and missed, but then stabbed, shot, and killed him. This was a very early convert to Mormonism, Parley Pratt. He was a big deal. These events tragically overlapped with one of the darkest moments in Mormon history, namely the Mountain Meadows Massacre. So the point I'm trying to make here with Parley Pratt is that the Mormons are paranoid, and they have some reason to be paranoid because one of their guys just got killed. He got killed because he was bringing a woman out whose husband was not happy about her leaving. So it was more of a domestic dispute. But nevertheless,
It fueled their fear of outsiders.
Yeah, it fuels a thing. Probably the darkest moment in Mormon history is what we're about to go through here. So, have you guys ever heard of the Mountain Meadows Massacre?
No.
No.
No. This is a sort of infamous moment in Mormon history. One of the earliest full accounts of the massacre came from T.B.H. Stenhouse in his book, The Rocky Mountain Saints. Stenhouse was by no means a biased author. Of the Mormons, he said that Brigham Young is by his natural instincts, not a bad man, or that his apostles and his bishops are not men of blood. This is true. Here and there among them is a malicious man, but apart from religion, the ruling men in Utah would be considered good citizens in any community. So I want to emphasize that Stenhouse is not out to get the Mormons here. He's just trying to tell the story of the Mountain Meadows Massacre as directly as he can. The story that he told did not recommend Mormon virtue. Two trains of emigrants were crossing the plains in 1857. From Missouri came a group of mostly men, the Missouri Wildcats, and from Arkansas, a group of kindred, or very near friends. The Arkansas Company was fairly wealthy. They paused from travel on Sundays to observe religious services and then continued on their way the next day. They were, according to those who crossed their path or traveled partway with them, an exceedingly fine company of emigrants, such as was seldom seen on the plains. No hoeing down for these guys.
These were classy people.
Classy people. It's sort of a funny picture because it is this little classy group of people who are, you know, fairly well off and have nice equipment and stuff. And then there's this just wild group of guys who call themselves the Wildcats who just hang out with them. And they're both crossing together.
They walk around on all fours. It's crazy.
So the Wildcats cats camped near them and were a picture in opposites, as I'm saying. They sang dirty songs and they swore by the campfire. But the two groups, by all accounts, traveled amicably.
The rich people had earplugs, so they were fine.
Yeah, they were good. Yeah, maybe they went to bed before the swearing started. And they traveled side by side. Like many travelers working their way west, they determined to rest and replenish at Salt Lake City and camp at the Jordan on their way to California. The trek from the Great Basin to California crossed a large swath of desert, and reprovisioning at the Salt Lake was important for survival. So yes, these guys are rich, is what I'm trying to say, but you just can't carry all the stuff you need to make it from civilization through the west to California.
Even I imagine being like very wealthy, travel was still travel. There was only so many ways to like make it more glamorous and easy. You still only had so many ways to travel, and that was it for everybody.
So you had to stop to reprovision. Shortly after arriving at the Jordan, the travelers were ordered to break camp and continue on their way, even though they had not adequate time to rest and provision themselves. Along the way, no Mormons would trade with them at Battle Creek, Provo, Springfield, Spanish Fork, Payson, Salt Creek, or Fillmore. Battle Creek, nobody traded with them. Provo, no. Springville, no. Spanish Fork, no. Payson, no. Salt Creek, no. Can you imagine?
That's a lot of stops without
running out of stuff at this point.
You're hungry, yeah.
Yeah.
An occasional Mormon would steal into their camp to deliver flour, but this was against the order that they'd been given. At Corn Creek, they were finally able to trade with some Indians and bought 30 bushels of corn before continuing on. They were not permitted to pass through the town of Parowan and went around the western fort wall. At Cedar City, they were able to buy wheat and have the corn milled. The fourth day after they left Cedar City, the Mormon militia took up in pursuit of them and then finally attacked. The wagon was not expecting to be assaulted, and they had separated themselves from a source of water where they were forced to circle their wagons. Let me just try and spell out what that means. If you expect you're going to be attacked and you're near a body of water, what you want to do is get close to that body of water so you can like literally circle the wagons and set up a situation where you can't be, there's like a siege wouldn't dry you out. You know what I mean? Like if you had to stay circled for days and days, you would have water. So these guys didn't realize they were going to be attacked, so they didn't bother to get close to the water.
Oh.
Yeah. The following is from an open letter written under the pen name Argus. Argus says, "They made several desperate but fatal and unsuccessful efforts to obtain water with the wagons circled, and finally, hoping there might be some little of humanity remaining with the Mormons, they dressed two little girls in white and started them with a bucket toward the spring. The soldiers shot them down."
Oh, I knew that wasn't going to end good.
Oh. No. The Mormon officer, General John D. Lee, offered the emigrants a truce flag, and they marched out and put down their arms and put themselves under General Lee's protection. The Mormons lined the emigrants up in separate groups of men and women and children and started a march towards Cedar City. I quote from Argus again here. After they had been marched about half a mile, Lee gave the word to halt. Then immediately the command to shoot them down was passed down the column, and before the poor emigrants could realize their situation, the first volley was delivered. Then, from the survivors, went up such a piercing, heart-rending scream, such a shriek of blank despair. Then the flight of all except one young woman, who sprang to Lee and clung to him for protection. Then the chase, then another volley, and then another, and still another, and then all was still.
So they just gave him this, like, false security, and then that's...
murdered them, yeah, en masse, yeah. While some children were killed in the massacre, this was unintentional. The order was that no children be shot. 17 were spared and taken in by Philip Kingston Smith. While Brigham Young did not give a direct order for the massacre, he was also loath to have it investigated, fearing that it would reflect poorly on the Mormons, as it has ever afterwards. So, Brigham Young is not directly responsible for this, but there were Mormons who, of their own accord, carried out the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And there is a Mormon doctrine that informed this, that came from Young. This is the doctrine of blood atonement. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
Maybe after I tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So the massacre was likely informed, as I'm saying, by the culture of blood atonement. And this was Young's teaching, his preaching. The parishes had been at one point, this is a family, the parishes, they had been devoted Mormons. I'm telling you another story here. The parishes had been devoted Mormons. But a decade after the death of Joseph Smith, they decided to leave the Utah Territory. On the 1st of March, 1857, two men, Abraham Durfee and Duff Potter, were appointed to act as spies on the parishes, acting as if they were also dissatisfied with the Mormons. On the 14th of March, Durfee and Potter offered to help them on their way out of the territory, but in fact, they led the family to a spot where they began to execute them. In the melee, Potter was also killed, stabbed by Parrish as Parrish was fighting for his life. His younger son escaped and ran back to Springfield, where he was questioned for having committed the murders, along with Durfee. And Orrin Parrish and Durfee were put on trial for the family's execution. That's right. A guy who did carry out the execution was put on trial with one of the people he tried to execute in the family. It's bizarre. Why did you kill your family with this guy, is what they're saying. Another would-be apostate, Henry Jones, also planned to leave the territory with his mother, and they were both killed before they could go. So what the hell is going on here? Why are they killing these people before they can leave? Young taught some version of blood atonement, wherein spilled blood cries out for retribution, but said it only made sense in a Mormon theocracy, which is exactly what he's running. The idea that anyone guilty of apostasy or a capital crime could not be atoned unless they themselves were killed is basically at the heart of this. So if you're going to become an apostate, if you're going to blaspheme, if you're going to leave the church, if you're going to commit heresy against the Mormon church, it is better that you die than that you be allowed to carry that out.
So was it more like implied to do the said, like carry out the said killing, or?
I suppose it was implied in the teaching, yeah, that this would be a good idea. Like if people are trying to leave the Mormon territory and leave the church, you should kill them to save their souls.
Jesus didn't die for your sins. You gotta die for your sins.
That's blood atonement. Yeah.
Oh.
The teaching was no urban legend. Blood atonement required the literal spilling of blood, which recommended two forms of execution, by gunshot and decapitation. In Utah, Decapitation was a viable means of state execution up through 1888, and up until 1994, jurors in Utah, let me say that again, 1994, the Clinton administration.
Sorry.
Jurors in Utah death penalty cases were asked routinely if they believed in the blood atonement.
That's so wild.
I think that our Mormon listeners, some of our Mormon listeners, may be like, ah, blood atonement, Rob, this is, you know, slander. This isn't true. None of this is true. But if that's the case, my friends, why during the Clinton administration are we asking jurors if they believe in the blood atonement? Clearly, this is a belief held by some Mormons.
If they were still asking this far into, this wasn't that long ago, well...
It's like, scary stuff.
No, I was saying that's like a few years before I was born. That's like,
yes,
I'm only 27.
It's not that long.
Not that long ago.
We said Brigham Young is cool, and he is. He can be very cool. He builds houses, and he helped that woman. He's a very compassionate, loving, resourceful, clever man. But this Blood Atonement stuff and the Mountain Meadows Massacre is bad news. He's not personally carrying this stuff out, but he's creating a culture where this can happen, and it's a culture of fear, really. It's very cult-like there.
Carry power when you're in some sort of position. That's
the way that he started out with, like, what seems like decent intentions and, like, as a decent person, and not all, but there are some cult leaders that start with a belief and a value that they think is, like, good and helpful, and then power, and the more people that believe what you're saying, like, it kind of gets to people. It seems like at a certain point, like, you can be a really good person, but if all of this power gets to your head, you start making weird decisions and, you know, kind of straying from maybe your original beliefs and making them more extreme.
Yeah. I mean, Brigham is pretty steady.
He's pretty extreme, just consistently.
Yeah, he's yes. I mean, he's all in on the polygamy. He's all in on the whole project of Utah. He is Utah in many ways. But I think that it's easy to forget that this is a brutal territory to live in. It's a brutal mm-hmm. territory to be a pioneer in. And life and death can sometimes feel a bit cheap. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes, or in these instances, this comes out in the Mormon story. And it doesn't bode well, right? As Christians. Well, any religion, really. While scandalous, Blood Atonement, or the Mountain Meadows Massacre, did not figure into the political forces that kept Utah from becoming a state. Remember, this episode is called Utah.
Oh, we're talking about Utah.
We've been talking so many about places. Utah.
The federal government's key problem with Utah was what? What would
I
you
was
guess?
Say Mormons,
the
but
polyamory, the polygamy.
Well, yes, you guys are both correct. It is the Mormons because they practice polygamy. Yes, good job.
Dynamic
good
duo.
Teamwork. Abraham Lincoln himself, who had been pro-Mormon when they were attacked by mobs back in Illinois, had signed an anti-bigamy bill into law in 1862. But it was difficult to enforce anti-bigamy laws in a territory, because it wasn't quite the United States. In her autobiography, Wife Number 19, Anne Eliza Young spoke out against Utah's... Yeah, Number 19. We're not sure if she actually was Number 19. It really depends on how you number the wives. There's some debate about that, but that was the title. It sounds good. It's a good title. Today we would make it like a Lifetime movie, right?
Oh yeah, I'd watch it.
A docuseries.
You're right. Yes, a docuseries. Yeah. Anne Eliza Young spoke out against Utah's spiritual wifery following her divorce from none other than Brigham. Anne Eliza Webb was born in a Mormon household in Nauvoo, the youngest of five children. So she's much younger than him, right? and she was a year old when her father took a second wife. She moved with her family to the Utah Territory, where she married James D. and had two sons, but the couple divorced. She married Brigham, not as his 19th wife, but probably as his 52nd.
Did you say 52nd?
I did say 50.
I think that'd be a good book title. Wife number 52.
I think it may be, I don't know, maybe that's just too much. 19 feels plausible.
She said this would probably seem like an exaggeration.
Did she mean she was 19 when she married him?
No, well, she'd already had one husband. I don't know how old she was. She wasn't old. She was probably in her 20s, early 20s. I think the numbering of the wives, like, you know, it's the connubial wives, right? Maybe she was the 19th connubial wife. That may have something to do with it. But she was the 52nd in consecutive order of all the wives he married. A Methodist minister boarded with Young, who may have encouraged Ann Eliza to split with Brigham. So this is sneaky. So this guy comes and boards on the Young, you know, compound, and he gets to talking with one of the wives. And he's like, you know, as a Methodist, oh, the Methodists are back. As a Methodist, we don't do this whole polygamy thing. This is kind of funky. You're sure you're all right with this, Ann Eliza? I'm not sure that the Lord loves this kind of thing. Us Methodists, we're a simple people. We're a Christian light, you might say. We don't have all these fancy, crazy systems. She filed for divorce in January 1873. The Methodist wins. It's a day for the Methodists.
Woo, Methodists.
And she was excommunicated in October 1874. So he waited a good long time to excommunicate her. So she filed for divorce in January 1873. It takes a whole year, almost 2 years, before he excommunicates her.
So, I mean, it's kind of nice that, like, people are allowed to get divorces and it doesn't immediately mean you're excommunicated.
How, what do I want to say to that?
Do they have a different stance on divorce?
No. I'm thinking about the time period. It is not easy to get a divorce, Nikki, in 1873, necessarily.
But they're, like, however, religiously allowed?
Well, you're a plural wife, so the state...
Oh, you're not even legally married.
Right. The state would not look kindly, and by the state I don't mean Utah, I mean like the United States. Mm-hmm. The government would not look kindly on you divorcing in like Maine, right? That's going to be a hard divorce to get, like, from your one husband. But in Utah, if you're literally wife number 52, there's no problem getting out of that arrangement.
Right. You can legally only be married to one person.
And polygamy makes it very easy to separate under any circumstances because the state looks down on it so much and they're so happy to see you go. But ordinarily the state in 1870s feels compelled to keep you in your marriage for the good of of society. Yeah. But yes, I disagree with that perspective.
Just to clarify.
Yeah, I've written extensively about this. I mean, Victoria Woodhull, right, is my go-to in the 1870s, and she's very pro-divorce. And she did divorce many times. And people did divorce, Nikki. Don't get me wrong. My spiritualist mediums, like Vicki Woodhull and Cora Scott Richmond, like these guys were married many times, and they did divorce husbands that they didn't like for whatever, their own reasons, right?
Just because they didn't like them. You don't need more... a reason.
Valid.
I'd say of these women that it helps to be a celebrity. I mean, these were successful, you know, famous women.
Yeah, if you had your own means of supporting yourself.
Woodhull ran her own stock brokerage, is funded by Vanderbilt, right? Cora Scott Richmond was a national celebrity. It's much easier. But for a regular woman, you know, workaday woman.
Not ideal.
No, it's a bad situation. In the divorce settlement, Ann Eliza was awarded $500 per month in alimony, but this was later set aside when the court determined that the marriage was invalid and that Brigham and Ann Eliza were cohabiting unlawfully. In April 1874, she testified before Congress encouraging the passage of the Poland Act, which removed Latter-day Saints' control of the legal system in the Utah Territory by giving the federal courts jurisdiction over all civil and criminal trials. This allowed the government to prosecute polygamists in the territory. Do you see how they did that? So, I mean, basically, how do you get at the bigamists? You can't. You can't do anything about polygamy if the courts are controlled by the state of Utah, and in the state of Utah, polygamy, I should say, is cool. only by turning the courts over to the federal government can you begin arresting people and trying them for bigamy.
So this is like slowly just turning it into a state that they can...
Which is what they were trying to do when they sent down their own federal government people to try to do that, and they didn't seem like they really did anything for a long time. Now it seems like they're kind of like getting into a plan of action.
I want to say this doesn't solve things. I mean, Utah is still Utah. It is still overwhelmingly Mormon, and Mormons overwhelmingly are on board with, you know, the Prophet Joseph Smith's teachings, which included, at the end of his life, polygamy. So it's not like this changing over or attempt to change over the court system is really going to change much, because it's still Mormons policing Mormons, because everybody's Mormon.
I was going to say, a jury of your peers sees nothing wrong with what you're doing.
Still Mormons. Finally, Utah banned polygamy at their 1895 Constitutional Convention. 1895. That's 20 years after Ann Eliza divorced Brigham Young. Oof. And were annexed into the United States in 1896. Utah holds the distinction of having its applications for statehood rejected the most of any state in the Union. Did you see my
eyes go out? What just happened?
was that Ann Eliza?
Is she in the room with us right now?
She said, I was upset. I could have gotten that money.
So my plants are on a grow light, and I didn't bother turning the light on in the room. And the grow light is on a timer, so every night it goes off. And
that's funny.
So I guess I'm finishing this one in the dark. Okay, Utah. You're not going to stop me. The state of Utah has cut off our electricity, but I'm soldiering on. So, Utah holds the distinction of having its application for statehood rejected the most of any state in the Union. The most. So they got turned down the most. They applied 7 times. They were rejected 6 times. 6 times I went down. Initially, the Saints sought statehood as a means of achieving autonomy. The first proposal was presented in 1849 by Stephen A. Douglas, debater of Abraham Lincoln, senator from Illinois, longtime friend of the Mormons, but was rejected because the Mormons did not have enough voting citizens. This was just a matter of numbers initially. Well, yeah, that's true. That's not going to do you any good.
Most of their population weren't enough wives, and they can't vote. So,
most of their population.
If only we had the numbers.
Too many wives. We need to have more husbands. So, yes. So, I don't mean to say that it's just a numbers issue in 1849. The numbers issue allows the United States to say, okay, get out of my house. We're not going to worry about you. If the numbers hadn't been an issue, then they would have had to talk about the other things. But the numbers are an issue, so we don't even think about it. In 1856, the fact that Utah had become a slave territory, coupled with the practice of polygamy, as I mentioned, kept them out. In 1862, when slavery was banned in the territories and bigamy was outlawed at the federal level, the state of Utah sent a copy of its previous constitution to Washington, and Washington ignored the hell out of it.
So, again, what am I going to do with this?
they left it on red. Yeah. Both thinking the internet terms there. In 1870, the state lost population to the new state of Nevada, but still had 86,000 citizens, clearing the 60,000 citizen threshold. But the Constitution only left room to debate polygamy later and not ban it outright, and so it died in committee. By 1882, and a non-Mormon liberal party, had sprung up in Utah to oppose statehood, but they disbanded when polygamy was officially banned in a manifesto by Wilford Woodruff in 1890. Woodruff was the church's fourth president. After Young died in 1877, he was succeeded by John Taylor, who was shot during Joseph Smith's assassination. By the way, so this is the second guy who survives. So remember we mentioned the first guy who survived. This other guy, John Taylor, became the third president of the church. So he made it all the way to the top. He led the church for 7 years, and then came Woodruff, who had been admitted to the 12 by Joseph Smith personally in 1838. So Woodruff was part of, you know, Joseph Smith's actual, you know, crew. We're on the fourth president, but Brigham Young, John Taylor, and Woodruff all knew Joseph Smith personally. I think Woodruff the least of the three, but nevertheless. Mm-hmm. Utah's Edmunds Tucker Act had stripped voting rights away from polygamous men and women, but also, ironically, something, from all women. So... Let me go back to Nikki's point about the wives. Yes, in the United States, women cannot vote, but women had voted in Utah going back to 1870. They didn't count as voting citizens from a U.S. perspective, but in the state,
they were,
women were voters.
Separated so they could do that. Oh, yes. Hey, I mean, chalk one up for that.
The Edmunds Tucker Act, which was meant to end polygamy, took women's right to vote away.
I don't know why those things have to go together. What, seems we only like have the right votes. To vote if we have sister wives? I don't see the correlation.
If you don't have sister wives, you have to be non-polygamous and a man now, says the Edmunds Tucker Act. I think what we're attempting to do with the Edmunds Tucker Act is align with the United States practice. At Utah's 1895 convention, most of the delegates supported women's right to vote, but decided they had to leave it out for fear the Congress would reject their constitution yet again. Congress required Utah to write a ban on polygamy directly into the Constitution and included the same requirement for all subsequent state constitutions up through Alaska and Hawaii. So yes, the state constitutions...
So from here on out, we're not going to have any more states doing this.
You all have to ban polygamy. So like New Jersey doesn't have a ban on polygamy in its constitution, but Alaska and Hawaii do because of Utah.
That's kind of funny.
Isn't that funny? So strange. All right, final thoughts on Utah, gang.
Polygamy's neat, I guess.
It's neat? Did you say it's neat?
I don't know. Yeah, sure.
It can be.
Yes.
Don't let a religion make you do that.
Polygamy?
If you're not comfortable with it.
What if you want to do it, Nikki?
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. No. If you want to do it. Live your best life. I'm just saying, don't let a religion pressure you into making any kind of life changes, like life choices that are that big, mm-hmm. such as who you marry, when you marry, why you marry,
how you marry.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All the
make your own choice. Make your own choice.
And if that means marrying 35 women, 52 women, I can't even keep track.
52
women.
At Ann Eliza, yeah.
I mean, if that makes
you
happy.
What's your take on
sounds
Brigham
exhausting.
Young? What do you guys think of Brigham?
Very, like, very innovative and very charismatic. Which, I mean, could be said for a lot of leaders of any group, spiritual, political, you know? Very mm-hmm. charismatic and innovative and had a way with people. And I
Tough
think he
guy.
Really did have values that he cared about, which I'm always more inclined to support people or like value their opinions if they believe in what they're saying with their whole heart. If people are grifting and they're using ideas to get power and money over people, that is more disturbing to me.
Mm-hmm. So good on Brigham for not being a grifter.
Yeah, he has values he stuck to, and I can kind of admire that.
What's the counterpoint there? But go
the
ahead, Jake.
Killing stuff. That's I think that's a
the blood atonement's pretty bad.
That's a pretty heavy thing to just like I said. When you're in a position of power, your words. Even if you didn't outrightly say something, they carry a lot, and people that follow you will run with that.
Got to be careful.
Yeah, you have to be careful with what you say. I do agree. Like, the dude was... That's very cool that he did care so much about the people that he was leading. I agree. It's kind of what makes... I don't want to say... Well, kind of what makes like a cult leader in a way when they are that like connecting and caring about their people. That's the easiest way to bring them in and then mold them. But
and get them to kill people for you or in the name of your cause.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah.
Turned out to be bad public relations. I don't know if he would have wanted any of that to happen, but it was an inevitable consequence, I think, and he should have probably thought that through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway. Very colorful history in Utah.
Are you guys ready to move to Utah?
I think I've driven through it twice now.
What? That was good for me. So okay in Canada.
Well, I don't think they have much caffeine there, Nikki. So
it's also, no offense, I don't want to get hated on, canceled for this. I'm good in Canada. Let's just say that. I'm happy where I am.
I don't know happy if that's a hot take.
Oh, you want to say some things about American politics?
It's scary. Yeah. I'm good here.
I understand. Yeah. So no Utah for you.
No, that's good. I'm good.
Would you move to the Utah Territory? How about that? What if it's 1872?
Move and to I the had Utah to Territory. Walk there and then yeah, try you gotta to walk survive. There.
All right. You guys don't want to walk. Sorry, I forgot.
Do you know anything about our generation walking?
Oh. Well, what if, Nikki, what if you got to ride in the back of a cart that swung you like cart. A hammock? Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty sick. That? I think I could get
like,
down with that.
Rock you to like sleep.
How much hoeing chill. Is allowed at the campsite?
No hoeing, I'm sorry. No you hoeing. Cannot hoe. You then can have you a song fest.
What's a song fest without some hoeing?
I mean, the theater kids ask me that all the time.
It's not right, okay? You take away my hoeing rights. I'm good where I am.
There's one thing I've learned about theater kids. Hey, songfest and hoeing go hand in
love
hand.
Love them a good songfest and a good hoeing. All right, let me just acknowledge some of our sources for this series. We're not done. I do have one more episode, but the final episode is about James Jesse Strang, who was a Mormon apostate. So I want to acknowledge some of the sources I used in compiling these first four episodes. Joseph Smith's, of course, Book of Mormon. D. Michael Quinn's Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, John L. Brooks' The Refiner's Fire, The Making of Mormon Cosmology, 1644 to 1844, Terrell Givens' Book of Mormon, Very Short Introduction, Lucy Smith, Max Smith's History of Joseph Smith, Benjamin Parks' Kingdom of Nauvoo, The Rise and Fall of a Religious Empire on the American Frontier, Lawrence Coates' Refugees Meet, The Mormons and Indians in Iowa, and T.B.H. Stenhouse's Rocky Mountain Saints, A Full and Complete History of the Mormons from the First Vision of Joseph Smith to the Last Courtship of Brigham Young. That's it. I hereby
so well.
I love a good long 19th century title. I hereby adjourn and declare close this meeting of the Secret Order of Alchemical Actors until such time as we get together and do it again. My name is Dr. Rob C. Thompson. I was and am and will be your supreme hierophant of the Alchemical Actors. Here to call confessions, joined by our Knight of the Dangling Serpent, Jake Wheatley.
Yeah, goodbye.
And Nikki Hiller Henderson, the Naked Truth.
Bye.
Are you trying to think of something else to say?
Nope, can't.
It's always so hard at like the end to come up with something. Saying goodbye. You never want to leave.
It's hard to say goodbye.
See you later. See you next time.
As I mentioned, James Jesse Strang is our next episode, who established a cult of Mormons in Michigan. And was assassinated, much like Joseph Smith. He even had his own golden plates. So it'll be a fun story, James Jesse Strang, here on A Call Confessions.